Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. You've likely heard about the 17-year cicada, last seen when the Macarena was popular. Long before the insects began to poke out of the ground along the East Coast, this species was making headlines for its wacky life cycle. Nature has plenty of examples of biological oddities, and science journalist Brandon Keim compiled a list of nature's strangest life cycles for Wired. Brandon, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Virginia. Glad to be here.
First, remind us about this 17-year cicada, and there's also a 13-year cicada, apparently. Well, why the evolution of this life cycle?
Well, nobody knows exactly for sure, but the idea is that it evolved over time and nowhere else except on the eastern coast of the United States as a predator defense mechanism. If you only come out of the ground every 13 years or every 17 years, like the ones we're about to see, then it's difficult for predators to specialize in eating you. And when you do emerge, it really doesn't matter how many of you get eaten just because there are billions of you. It's really a force of nature to be reckoned with when they come out.
Quite a strategy, if that's what it is. But some of nature's strangest life cycles evolve from parasitic relationships. Why is that? And what are some examples?
You know, actually, my interest in the entire notion of strange life cycles began with parasites, and it began with one that isn't even on the list. And it's a yellow grub that lives in fish. And so what had happened is that about 15 or 20 years ago, my buddy and I caught some smallmouth bass down in the stream behind my mother's house. And then I hope nobody from the Maine Department of Fish and Wildlife is listening. We took some of these bass in a bucket and put them in my mom's pond. And then over the years, we would go and catch them. And so one day we wanted to eat some, and we caught them and took them back up to the house and went to clean them. And they were just filled with these, you know, wriggling little yellow grubs. And so, you know, I went to learn about the yellow grubs since I couldn't eat the fish. And it turned out that what happened is when there's enough of these in a fish, they drift towards its brain and alter its behavior in such a way that it swims closer to the top of the water and is more likely to be eaten by a heron. And then the parasite needs to be inside the heron in order for the next stage of its life cycle to occur. And then they reproduce and lay their eggs, which drop out of the heron and go back into the water and are picked up by a fish. And, you know, it's just such a complicated multi-stage process, and you see that in so many parasites. And, you know, I don't know if anybody is exactly sure how this evolves over time. Clearly it does, but what are the, you know, the individual genetic and environmental steps necessary to make this happen? It's really a beautiful mystery.
There are also some examples you use of mutual dependence. For one, the symbiotic salamander. Tell us a little bit about that creature.
Well, it's a little bit late in the year for people to go out and see the eggs on invernal pools on the forest floors, I believe, although you might actually see the young salamanders now. But what happens is, so for a long time, you know, biologists would look at the eggs of the salamander, and they could see the little flecks of green floating around inside. And so they knew algae was there. But then the question is, you know, so is the algae sort of floating around in the eggs, or is it really part of the organism? And what researchers have found out in the last few years is that the algae is inside the salamanders as they begin to develop. And so they're, you know, in this very happy environment for algae. It's warm and nitrogen rich and all this. And then at the same time, they're also processing nutrients that are thought to be important to salamander development. And it may actually be the case that these algae are with a salamander over the course of its life. And if it's a female, she'll pass the algae on to her offspring. You know, I don't think there's another example in the natural kingdom like that, and I'm sure a biologist will call in and correct me any moment now, but where a creature passes on another complex organism, you know, not just the bacteria that you pass on to your offspring, which we all do, but algae, you know? I mean, you can see them with your naked eye. It's extraordinary.
Well, and that's a symbiotic relationship, but conversely, the whiptail lizard. Now, this is a sort of model of independence. How does the reproductive cycle of the whiptail lizard work?
Here's where we get into some really complex genetics that when I'm writing articles about them, I usually approach with four or five browser windows open and a scientist at my side to walk me through. So the whiptail lizards, there's actually a great many species of them that live in the southwest United States. Many of them have only females, and they reproduce by cloning themselves. So there's no sexual reproduction. They just give birth. It's called parthenogenesis. And, you know, it was actually thought for a long time. There's, you know, that this was some sort of evolutionary dead end, you know, like something went wrong. Now they reproduce without sex. And over time, there's not going to be enough genetic diversity in their populations for them to be sustained. But, you know, what we've figured out now, or what we realize now, is there's something like 80 groups of animals that over time have, you know, accumulated the mutations they needed in order to go sex-free. And so this does seem to be a pretty successful way of going about your life.
Well, and, it would certainly cut down on distractions.
It does that. You know, it's also, in addition to species that go without sex, there's also quite a few species that change sex in the course of their lives. And one of these is the clownfish, best known from Finding Nemo. They're what are called sequential hermaphrodites.
This is the species that actually changes from male into female, which is unlike most hermaphroditic species.
That's right. There's quite a few species out there where the females turn into males. But with clownfish, it's the opposite. And actually, what may happen when Nemo grows up is that if he lives in a colony of clownfish where the dominant female dies or is eaten, then the next ranking, the highest ranking male, will become a female and take her place. You know, it's very easy for us. You know, we all love to look at these animals and say, oh, you know, isn't that amazing or wonderful or strange or bizarre? And all of that's true. You know, but these aren't just biological curiosity boxes. These are beings with an awareness of themselves and an awareness of the world. And then you kind of wonder, you know, what goes through a fish's mind when it goes from being a male to a female? And, you know, how does it experience the world any differently? And that's something I like to wonder about.
We're talking with Brandon Keim about some of nature's more bizarre life cycles and phenomena. He's a science journalist who wrote about the subject for Wired magazine. You write about another species, the migratory eel, that has a bizarre back and forth in order to reproduce. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, right from the beginning, eels really go the other way. Every other migratory fish starts out in freshwater. They reproduce in freshwater and are born there, and then they go out to sea, and that's where they become big, and then they go back to freshwater to spawn. But with the eels, it's the opposite. They actually are born at sea, and they're these tiny little, you know, glass eels is what they're called, you know, a few centimeters long and, you know, transparent to the naked eye. And for a long time, scientists didn't even realize that they were the same species as adult eels. They're just completely different creatures. And so they're out there somewhere in the Sargasso Sea, and the currents take them close to land. And somehow they just know to swim up rivers. And at this point, they are still genderless. Somewhere along this journey, they change sex. They become male or female, and nobody really knows exactly what that trigger is and what determines it. And then at some point, they go back out. And what's really amazing is that they will swim back to where they were born, you know, as these tiny little fingerlings, thousands of miles out in the sea, you know, with, let's say, a salmon, a creature that is, when it's born in a stream, and, you know, it's still incredible that it's able to find its way back there to spawn as an adult, but at least it's a fixed point in space, and you can kind of imagine how it is that maybe it gets imprinted with that location geomagnetically or what have you. But with eels, they're swimming back not to a fixed point in the ocean, but to some sort of particular place where the current does a certain thing, or, you know, some water feature, essentially, which is going to be drifting over time. So somehow they find their way back to that, thousands of miles away out in the Sargasso. And nobody has actually seen eels reproduce. There's an artist named James Prosek who has done some wonderful art and research and advocacy on the part of eels. And I urge everybody to go online and look at the painting he made of what an eel spawning mass might look like, because it's an incredible thing to see.
We'll make sure and put a link to that on our website, wordofmouthradio.org.